Today on Focal Point from Pastor Mike Fabares.
Colossians chapter 2, verse 23. This is another kind of quote-unquote religion. It seems like a bond and a worship and a devotion to the transcendent God. It has an appearance of wisdom, but it really is a self-made religion. I'm going to say what we're talking about here, to use a biblical category, we're talking about something that is worldly, worldly religion.
And welcome to Focal Point. I'm your host, Dave Drewy, and I'm so glad you joined us today as Pastor Mike Fabares kicks off a new series called When the World Gets in the Way. We're learning how to overcome the challenges and distractions that we face in our 21st century world in order to fully be focused on God's kingdom and mission. And today we're talking about the dangers of worldly religion. How is that different from biblical faith? Well, let's jump into the message and find out.
Well, if you happen to be into high-end art, you may be familiar with the Los Angeles Art Association. Near its headquarters on North La Cienega up there in LA, there are a lot of very artsy places up there. In the shadow of it, I mean, you'd think it would be a place where you'd have a lot of art lovers opening up galleries. There is a place just south of the Los Angeles Art Association headquarters called the Chateau Allegra. So West Hollywood, and it's filled with all kinds of art. And you could walk into that place for years and talk with the owner. She was a gal who'd been in the business for 40 years. She knows all about art. She can appraise art. You could talk art all day long with this gal. But informed people don't do that anymore, since they read about her in the LA Times, which said that she sold what she claimed was a $5 million Picasso to a gal in LA for $2 million. Must have ran like a coupon in the Penny Saver or something. She should have known this is quite a deal. It was a deal, except it wasn't a deal because it was a fraud. She had hired a art student, paid him $1,000 to replicate this famous Picasso painting, and then passed it off as a $5 million work and sold it for $2 million, and then that's when the FBI eventually got involved and she was exposed. I mean, you'd think you could walk into this swanky La Cienega, West Hollywood gallery. It looks like, it sounds like, it smells like a legitimate art gallery with legitimate art purveyors in it, but you know, you wouldn't think you'd get bamboozled and hoodwinked by this person, but that's exactly what happens. She can say she loves art all day long, but really you can tell by her actions she loves herself a whole lot more and loves her pocketbook. I mean, that is what she ended up proving she was all about. Which, by the way, that's a good principle, not just when you're dealing with fine art, but when you're trying to deal with religion. When you're dealing with people that say they are purveyors of the truth of God, when you're trying to make some kind of spiritual transaction in places where, frankly, God has designed it for us to need the kind of counsel, help, teaching, instruction that you have from people that claim to know God, claim to know God's truth. I mean, you got to make sure that these people that claim to love God really don't love themselves more, because our world is filled with spiritual deception and religious counterfeits. And I know we'd like to think, you know, if you wear the Jesus jersey, you're on my team. But in reality, you'd better have discernment in our world. And it's always been that way. It's not a 21st century problem, although it is a great problem. It was a first century problem. And if you were a fisherman or a tax collector or a physician and you were looking to try and do some kind of transaction with God and you wanted information about God, the go-to guys in the first century were a group of guys called the Pharisees. Now, I know you know them, and I know, you know, you sneer, and because from the time you were in second grade, you saw the flannel graph Sunday school stories, your teachers threw them under the bus, these are the bad guys. But before you get so simplistic in your thinking about the Pharisees that, oh, the bad guys have entered the scene, just know that these were the guys in the first century who knew the Word of God. They'd been educated. They could quote it. They could teach it. They could explain it. They were fully familiar with it, and they sat, as Jesus said, in the seat of Moses in these synagogues, and they taught it. And Jesus didn't say, oh, go to another place and get taught. No, he says, when they sit in the seat of Moses and they teach you, listen and do what they say. Now, why is it that we teach on our flannel graph second grade classroom stories that the Pharisees were bad guys? Why do we do that? Well, because we know we've read the New Testament. Jesus comes on the scene and shines light on them like an X-ray machine and exposes them for who they are. And what is that? They're frauds. They don't love God with all their heart, soul, strength, and mind. They love themselves. And that was his constant exposure. And he says, you know what, you got to listen to what they're saying because they are teaching you the word, but you better not follow their example, because if they make a convert of their lives, the converts are twice as much a son of hell as they are. These guys are going to lead you to hell. These guys will lead you astray. Now, we learn that from the teaching of Christ, and we see it in passages like the one we've come to. And what we need to learn from a passage like the one we've come to in Luke chapter 14, verses 1 through 6, is that what's going on in this passage, we should leave this text with a heightened discernment, as uncomfortable and as kind of unpopular as it is for us as Christians to be discerning Christians, looking at people that may name the name of Christ and saying, wait a minute, not everybody who claims the name of Christ is teaching me the right way about God. We need to come away with a discernment, not only to know that group shouldn't be a part of that. And that may become counsel for you with friends, neighbors, and family members, because you may say, well, I'm here. I'm at Compass Bible Church. I mean, I'm about this church and this doctrine, and that's great. But as I said, in the first century, Jesus didn't tell these guys to go to a different synagogue. He said, you got to listen here, but here's the problem. Don't let the problems of the Pharisees creep into your own heart. And I got to say this, you can stay in good Bible-teaching churches your whole life and still have the problem that we're about to expose in Luke chapter 14. So it's not just you being equipped by a passage like this to know that you should say to someone, well, if these symptoms are in place in that group, don't go join that group. It's about you sitting in a good church and saying, I want to make sure those things don't creep into my heart. So let's look at this passage and see the clear contrast between the Pharisees and Christ, which I know you expect. You'll learn that in the second grade. But let's at least try and say, what can we learn that will help us discern, not only for the good of our counsel, but for the good of our own heart, so that we act more like Jesus and less like the Pharisees. Verse number one, we'll look at six verses, Luke chapter 14. Follow along as I read it for you. One Sabbath, the scripture says, when he, that is Christ, went to dine at the house of a, now this would be a good word to underline, highlight, bracket, a ruler of the Pharisees. Now that's an important distinction. This isn't just a rank and file Pharisee. These are the top dogs, the leaders. Matter of fact, this word, a lot of people think, well, clearly it's the kind of word you would use for someone on the Supreme Court of the religious Jews, the Sanhedrin. Maybe this is one of the council sitting Pharisees. We don't know. We don't even know where this is. But we know this was a big time, high ranking, lots of stripes on his arm kind of spiritual leader. And then look at this, strangely enough, they were watching him carefully. Translation of a phrase that gives you the sense that they were kind of surveilling him. This isn't just, hey, you know, did he have an extra scoop of falafel or, you know, no, that's, it was like they're watching. Now we have in other passages, clearly we know with more explanation, they were watching him so as to catch him in some wrongdoing. And clearly the passage makes that seem that this is the case. So we assume there's a trap being set for him. And sure enough, I think the language starts to expose that clearly is the preponderance of what we should come away with in this passage, that they had set up this dinner after church, if you will, and they're sitting around having dinner and they're watching him, and behold, here's interesting verbiage, like here, wow, and then bam, here comes a man before him who had dropsy. Now I'll bet $100 you didn't use the word dropsy in any normal conversations this week, am I right? What is dropsy? I keep dropping things, a dropping disease, what is that? Edema, if you go to the doctor and you hear that word, that may be a word that's a little more common to our lexical use in our day. I mean, you look it up and you find, well, it's not a disease at all. It's really a symptom. So he's describing a man with a symptom. And the symptom is, if you want you to explain edema is something when you sprain your ankle gets big. I mean, that at least is a small example of edema. You have a buildup of fluids in your body, but it's not real classic edema. The real kind of examples of severe edema that give you a sense that there's a severe problem, because it's a symptom of a problem, not the problem itself, is the kind of buildup of fluids in your body, and it can be in a lot of places. If you look up on Google right now and try and find some kind of image search on edema, you'll find that in some cases, it just becomes distortingly grotesque as parts of your body distend and swell, and you can put your finger on people's skin and pull your finger away, and there's a dent there for a while as the fluids kind of seep back into it. It's gross. And you can see if it's in the legs or extremities, and our passage doesn't tell us where it was, you can see someone with a normal leg, and then the other leg has edema, and it's like elephantitis. If you remember that phrase, have you ever looked that one up? I mean, not before lunch, but just gross, huge. Sometimes it's in the thoracic cavity in your body. It can be in various parts of your body. It really is a symptom. It can be a massive liver disease. It could be caused, I mean, every time there's congestive heart failure, there's expressions of this in different parts of the body. It might be a severe infection of some kind that's causing this reaction in the body. It could be a blood clot in an extremity that might start to cause this. Whatever it is, it's not just a little swelling in his elbow. This was something that when even the word behold, he walks in and here is a somewhat disfigured person, and you know how they dressed, right? You've seen those from the flannel graph. I mean, they got these robes on. This was something so bad, you could see it, everyone could see it, and he was disfigured, and it was one when you'd see him walking and go, oh, poor guy, ah. And there he is with dropsy. Here's another thing that shows us this is a showdown, verse 3. And Jesus, what's the next word? Responded. They didn't ask anything. They didn't say anything. No, but they threw him in a situation, put this ill man in front of him. He's disfigured, and so he's going to respond to that. And he responds with a question to the lawyers, the teachers of the law, and the Pharisees. And here's what he said. He asked the question, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Now, he knew that's what they're setting him up for. Right? Is he going to heal on the Sabbath? We've hit this two or three times already in the Gospel of Luke. And we know he's making religious leaders mad. Pharisees, scribes have been involved, watching, and they're angry that he's breaking the Sabbath, which of course he's not. We've talked about that in the past. He's not breaking the Sabbath. I mean, he certainly isn't breaking a sweat, that's for sure, when he's touching people and healing them or speaking a word and healing them. I mean, clearly this doesn't work. Not to mention, how do you even fit this into a category of whether it's allowed or not? How can the rabbis even weigh in on this? You don't have people walking around speaking words and healing people. It's not like, oh yeah, Bob did that, and we got him in trouble for it too because he was working. What? This hasn't happened since the time of Elijah and Elisha, right? It has been hundreds of years since we've seen stuff like this happening in Israel. So he says, listen, let's just think about this. Healing, which doesn't normally happen. I mean, it didn't happen in anybody's lifetime in the room as he sits there and talks to these people. Is it wrong for me to heal this guy? Now, if you think about it long enough, I wish we had time to think through every nuance of this passage, you could start thinking, what if they answered yes? What if they answered no? Whatever. That's a great question to ask them, but they decided to decline on answering. They remained silent, verse 4. Then he, Christ, took him, the man with edema, and he healed him and sent him away. It's like he was the guinea pig set up there like a pawn. What's he going to do? He touches him, takes hold of him, heals him, and then says, okay, you've done, go. Now I'm going to talk to these guys. And by the way, for those of us that are so used to watching the charlatans on TV, quote unquote, heal people when they have a tumor that you can't see or a headache or something, this is not like that at all. I told you, if you're in a robe, this is such a disfiguring kind of symptom of some kind of problem that's not even identified by Dr. Luke, but it is something so severe that you've got parts of your body distended and swollen, and Jesus grabs this guy, and bam, where does all that stuff go? Now think on a cellular level. This is not like all of a sudden he starts on a path to healing. This is not, if you know my terminology, a GT2. It's not a God thing too. It's not a second class category providential miracle that works within the laws of nature. It is a GT1. It is a God thing one. It is a miracle of the first order when God breaks natural law, because here are fluids that don't belong outside of their proper abode, shouldn't be there in their limbs. Let's just say it's in a leg, and it shouldn't be the way it is. And then instantly he touches them, and then it goes, whoop. It's like a cartoon. Bam. I mean, that is an amazing act of divine power where God, just like he did at creation, speaks a word, and things that didn't exist because he's the creator of all things can speak and change cellular realities at an atomic level with the word of his power. Jesus shows his credentials. Now, again, if you've been through Luke with me, we've looked at passages like this. We've dealt with Sabbath issues. I relegated that to the reading list on the back or sermons in the past. We've dealt with credential issues of his messiahship. Let's deal with this, which I think in its context is really the lesson we're supposed to take away from this, and that is exposing the Pharisees for the frauds that they were. Keep reading the rest. And he said to them, "Which of you having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on a Sabbath day," you're all uptight about your traditions on the Sabbath day, "will not immediately pull him out?" I bet you would. You'd do that for your kid, and you'd even do it for your animal. You'd do that. Now, that question clearly condemned these guys for taking a man who had such extreme symptoms of something that related to some kind of serious problem that threatened his life. Who knows how much longer this guy would have lived in the state that he was in, and you now are going to condemn me for helping this guy on the wrong day of the week when you would reach out and save your own ox out of a pit or a ditch or a well? You guys are hypocrites. You guys are on the other side of the tracks when it comes to what we're doing. What I'm doing and what you're doing, two different things. I know both people are looked at. The church ruler of the Pharisees, the ruling Pharisee, and Jesus. If we wanted a go-to guy to learn about God and how to get right with God, both of those guys would be on the menu. But it may look like we're both going to lead people to God, but we are in radically different orbits here. Two different worlds. I want to make sure, and I know this sounds like second grade Sunday school, but I want to make sure I'm living on the side of Christ here, and I'm not reflecting anything that the Pharisees are reflecting. When he said that, they couldn't reply. He shut them up. Nothing you can say. What do we learn from this? Quick historical narrative. Let's step back and learn something about the difference between the Pharisees and Christ. Let's start with the Pharisees, and let's see what their problem was. I'm going to give you a label here if you're taking notes, and I wish that you would. Number one on your outline. Let us beware of worldly religion. Let's write that down. Let's beware of worldly religion. Jot that down for me, and then let's think about what I'm saying. I am now accusing the Pharisees of having worldly religion. And before you say, "Oh, cool, Mike, peace out." Yeah, we're not into religion, man. We're into Jesus. We're into relationship. Stop. Okay, that worked in the sixth grade. But you're all adults here, right? Religion is not a bad word. Oh, no, it's not a bad word. It's used six times in the New Testament, translating into our language, religion. It's not a bad word at all. As a matter of fact, religion reflects my commitment, if you even go back to the way it translates from Greek into English, to the bond that I have in expressing my devotion and my worship to the transcendent God. I mean, it's a good word. Let me give you two passages if you're a copious note taker. Let's start with this one. James chapter 2. Here's the problem, is that people don't know that when God puts the word religion on the pages of Scripture, sometimes he says it's good. Our devotion and commitment to the God of the universe is good. And here's how he describes it, as pure and undefiled. There is a religion he wants us to have and not be afraid to say. If someone says, "Are you religious?" on an airplane when you're traveling this week, you could say, "Yes, I am. I'm all about the pure and undefiled religion of the Bible." There's nothing wrong with that sentence, even though, the hip hoppers won't think that's a cool thing if they're Christian artists or whatever. They think it's not bad. It's a good thing. Not that I can salvage this word in one sermon, but I just want to at least be a good teacher to you this morning and say nothing wrong with that word. The problem is the kind that's described, jot this one down now if you would, in Colossians chapter 2, verse 23. It says there's another kind of, quote unquote, religion. It seems like a bond and a worship and a devotion to the transcendent God, where humans are connected to this God. That is, here's what it's called, here's how it translates, a self-made religion. He says in that context, it has an appearance of wisdom, but it really is a self-made religion. Now I'm going to take the word self-made, and for the sake of our series, I'm going to say what we're talking about here, to use a biblical category, we're talking about something that is worldly, worldly religion. When it comes to religion, and I should say this, because some say, well, it seems like religious people are on the right track, and it's the atheists and agnostics and the non-religious that are on the wrong track. If you really track the sociological trends in America is becoming increasingly non-religious, you'll say, well, those are the bad guys, but the religious people, those are the good guys. Just know this. Even in our day when we're trying to be so scientific and so modern and so postmodern that we're not religious anymore, everyone is religious. We are religious. Because even the atheists, which I was reading on some websites this week, and the naturalists, You know, these empiricists, people that try to explain everything in human terms, are always trying to reach to the transcendent and their own well-being after death. I've quoted these stats for you before, and I've had the statistical studies and the footnotes and all the rest, but when you really poll the agnostics and the atheists, more than half of them are praying. They're praying to what? To who? They ask for help from some transcendent something. They believe in the afterlife. They hope in heaven. There was a whole series of articles this week that were noted by some social commentators about how these naturalists continue to say, well, we don't believe in the God of the Bible, and we don't believe in hell, but we certainly believe that there's an afterlife, and there's hope, and that there's something more to me than just the cells in my body. And that's a religious kind of reaching beyond to the transcendent that everyone is. And even though I think that the stats in America are probably at a relatively high, if not supremely high mark right now, when it comes to atheism, real atheism, which is nothing more than living in a contradictory state of mind and worldview, it isn't going to do much better than it is right now. You can say you're an atheist all day long, but it's never gotten out of double digits in our country. Why? Because we are innately religious. We want there to be more than this life, because why? According to the Bible, he's designed us to reflect who he is. To put it in the terms of Ecclesiastes, he has set eternity in our hearts. And people are going to cry out for the thing that we're made for, and that is for God. We just don't want the God of the Bible. So what we like is self-made religion. That's why there are so many religious options. And that's why I'm saying, hey, when it comes down to it, there's counterfeits. And you know what? The Pharisees were counterfeit frauds. And a lot of what they taught, not what they read from the scripture in the seed of Moses, but what they taught was fraudulent, and it would lead people to hell. And we've got a world like that too, and I know you'd like to say, hey, if you're pro-Jesus, I'm on your team. Right? You meet a guy at the airport, and he says, oh yeah, I love God. Oh, great, man, high five, we're brothers. Super, gotta be super careful. Oh, I don't want to be that persnickety, you know, discerning, judgmental person. Listen, if you're not going to be discerning about this, you're going to start to affirm groups of people just because they have the Jesus jersey on, that will then take people in your surrounding life that might say, well, then that's okay for me. And I've seen people as recently as last night tell me because of their approval of things that they were not discerning about, now family members are involved and they recognize this is leading them to hell. And I've got to be super careful about what you approve. I'm not trying to turn you into some persnickety kind of judgmental person, to use the world's language, but I do want you to recognize that just because they're wearing the Jesus jersey and they say they love God, it doesn't mean it's right. Jesus said about these Pharisees, when they make a convert, they make them twice as much a son of hell as themselves. Now, I don't think you want to risk that for your friends, loved ones, and family members. So we need to be careful. We need to realize what's going on when it comes to worldly religion.
A sobering cautionary reminder from Mike Fabares on Focal Point. Pastor Mike titled this message, Worldly Religion and Godly Priorities, and it's the first part of his series called When the World Gets in the Way. Now, if you're just tuning in, or if you missed the beginning of the program, don't forget that you can hear the complete sermon on our website free of charge. Just go to focalpointradio.org. You know, Pastor Mike's teaching is completely free to access thanks to support from a very special group of friends called Focal Point Partners. Now, these are listeners just like you who believe in our mission to explore and proclaim the depths of Scripture. As a partner, your gift to Focal Point is automatically withdrawn each month, providing a firm foundation that we can rely on as we expand and reach new audiences with hard-hitting, straightforward Bible teaching. Now, perhaps you've been listening for a while. Maybe you've even given before, but you haven't taken the step to become a partner. Well, will you do that today? When you do, we'll say thanks with a copy of Pastor Mike's year-long devotional called Change My Heart, O God. And whether you become a Focal Point partner, or if you make a single donation today, we'll send you a practical book from Christian author, blogger, and church leader Tim Challies, titled Do More Better. In our fast-paced culture, this book helps us focus our efforts so we can stop spinning our wheels and become more productive at what truly matters. Don't just do more better, and do it all for the glory of God. Request your copy of this hands-on guide to godly productivity when you become a Focal Point partner or when you give a single gift today. Call 888-320-5885 or donate online at focalpointradio.org. Well, I'm your host, Dave Drewy. Tomorrow we'll be diving back into our series called When the World Gets in the Way. So be sure to join us Tuesday for Focal Point.
Hey there, Pastor Mike here. We're almost out of time, but before we go, I wanted to personally invite you to contact us here. Let us know how we can be praying for you. Head on over to focalpointradio.org and click the contact page, or send me a note on Facebook, facebook.com/Pastor Mike, or twitter.com/Pastor Mike. Can't wait to hear from you.
Today's program was produced and sponsored by Focal Point Ministries.